Welcome to Local Talk, Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franson and Gina McAndrews, but I believe you told me you have some special guests who have been hosts in the past, Susan.
Of course, all of our guests are special. But since Dennis Hart is only in town for a few weeks, and since we have been able to reconnect with Paul Wearson by phone, we thought we'd bring them together to get their perspective on life after COVID. So stay tuned. And thanks for joining me today, Gina.
Hello, Susan. As usual, it's always good to be here. Always interesting things happening. I guess there's no more Lives Matter marches right now, but I guess there was a demonstration at Cat Hall. Are we going to talk with anyone from the protest, Susan?
Not directly, but we're going to uplift the work of the important Black women suffrage leaders from Iowa. There was a webinar yesterday at the State Historical Society on its current exhibit, Toward a Universal Suffrage, African American Women in Iowa, and the Vote for All. And we're going to hear about that and more from its curator, Eric Morse.
Well, it sounds like we're definitely going to learn something. Anything else before Dennis and Paul?
We have a couple of announcements, but I'll wait till later in the show for those. I think Eric has some new information for us, part of the discovery that has come of demands to explore a history that we hadn't imagined. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Susan, and good morning, Gina.
Good morning.
Why don't you tell us, Eric, a little about yourself? Why did you decide to start a museum, and what kind of exhibits do you have?
Sure. So the museum I'm starting is called the Central Iowa Community Museum. It's sort of a long story about how I got to create that museum, but I'll do my best to keep it short. I had an interest in art history and was originally going to go back to school to get my master's degree in art history, but because I don't know a second language, I decided to go back for museum studies instead. And after I got that graduate degree, I worked at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden. I also did some consulting work for the Des Moines Art Center. But I decided to create the Central Iowa Community Museum because I have some frustration with museums and the fact that they have not been telling diverse and inclusive stories about the communities as much as they should or they could. So the whole idea about the community museum is that it's not about objects per se. It's more about people and issues. I want to do a lot of issues-based exhibitions. And I want this to be a place where you can come and learn about other people and about the issues that are important to them. And then you can feel empowered to take some action to advocate for those issues.
Well, it sounds like this is the perfect time to start such a venture.
It would be, except the whole pandemic is kind of making things a little bit difficult. Of course, museums have been closed and some are just starting to reopen.
What I really was thinking about was various virtual ways of reaching out.
Sure.
I mean, for example, the webinar that you had yesterday. Why don't you describe that webinar and what was on it? And how you present it.
Sure. So the exhibition, the Community Museum's first exhibition is called Toward a Universal Suffrage, African American Women in Iowa and the Vote for All. It's an exhibit that is traveling throughout the state into next year. And it is currently at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines. And they have a series of programming at the State Historical Museum this year to celebrate the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in all elections. And they asked myself and one of the other exhibition partners, Kristen Corey from the Office on the Status of Women at the Iowa Department of Human Rights, to give a little talk about the exhibition. And so we highlighted some of the African-American women suffragists who were active here in Iowa We talked about the history of voting rights and that struggle for African-Americans and kind of all women in general to win the vote. And then we also talked about some of the women who followed in the footsteps of those suffragists in terms of some kind of civil rights leaders here in Iowa. And then we kind of ended the presentation bringing it up to the present day. So despite the fact that African-Americans can vote, they still face a lot of obstacles to casting their ballots. And in many ways, the project of suffrage is not yet completed.
No, it's not yet completed. And as I was going online to learn a little bit more background, I became aware of something that's really ironic, because one of the women who is best known, not so much for her advocacy for the amendment, but for her writing, is Ida B. Wells. And she was, her big campaign was anti-lynching. And what do we have right now, 2020, before Congress? One of the very few things that the Democrats and Republicans can agree on, an anti-lynching legislation. And
yes,
that should be needed in 2020 is pretty significant.
Yes. And in fact, I would say, Susan, it's been needed, you know, for over 100 years. Mary Church Terrell, who was not an African-American from Iowa, I think she was from Kentucky or Tennessee, she was a national African-American suffrage leader. And one of the things that she advocated for was a stop to lynching, as all African-Americans advocated for that. And she had a close friend who was lynched. And at the time, it was President Harrison who was president. And she led an effort to try and get him to speak out against lynching, and he refused to do so. And so it's unfortunate that even today, you know, our political leaders cannot, you know, pass an anti-lynching bill.
Yes, it's amazing. I checked this issue online last night and learned that since at least the 1890s, members of the House and Senate have tried to pass a law making lynching a federal crime. The bills were consistently blocked, shelved, or ignored. It was not until 2018 that such a bill passed the Senate by unanimous consent. Finally, something that both parties could agree to. And in February 2020, the House passed a similar bill, 410-4. And the four who opposed it were mostly technical reasons, like federal bills didn't have the death penalty and some states did. It's only waiting for the president's signature, but he hasn't indicated any special interest in signing it. So we'll see how long it takes to get a federal law against lynching. In thinking about this and the history of the difficulties that are partly behind these cat demonstrations, just what happened, you know, just how this suffrage developed. I mean, the early women suffrage leaders started out as abolitionists. And
yes.
And that's why Frederick Douglass spoke at their meetings, and some of their most famous early suffrage leaders, like Sojourner Truth, were,
correct,
of course, anti-slavery. And so when the 15th Amendment that gave black men the right to vote, was it ever considered that that might be a real universal suffrage, that women would get the vote at the same time? Nobody suggested it, right?
Well, there was, I mean, women were definitely advocating to be included in that amendment, but it ultimately was interpreted to apply only to men. So the amendment said that the right to vote could not be denied based on race, color, or previous servitude, but it didn't really address sex, and that's why it was interpreted to apply to men only.
Yeah, and I mean, that's when am I correct that was really when lynching started, was after black men could vote?
Yeah, I think, obviously slaveholders could do whatever they wanted to their slaves, but lynching became much more of a problem in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Well, but to get back to the exhibit in the State Historical Society, and also your future for the Central Iowa Museum, History Museum, if COVID were gone and you didn't have to worry about online events and virtual events, you don't have a space, correct? You don't have a building.
Not yet. We're going to build up to the space. What my plan here, Susan, is I want to do a series of temporary exhibitions like Toward a Universal Suffrage. And I want to get to kind of introduce people to the type of exhibitions that the museum would do and then try and build support that way for the idea in the museum with the hopes of then getting our own permanent location.
It does seem to me with your purpose that a traveling exhibition is more suitable than bringing it into schools, bringing it from town to town.
Exactly. And what we're hearing from a lot of people, especially in the rural parts of Iowa, is that they don't get enough of this type of thing right where they live. So that's kind of one of the things that I'm actually exploring and thinking about through this project is how can we create more exhibitions like this and get them out to people in rural areas?
Well, to get back to the one that you're currently presenting, who were some of these Black women in Iowa?
Sure. So one was Gertrude Durden Rush. She was from Texas, and she was the daughter of a Baptist minister. So her and her family moved around a little bit. She spent time living in Kansas and Illinois, and in the late 1800s and early 1900s, she was a teacher, and she taught in Kansas, in Oklahoma, and she also taught in Des Moines. That's how she made her way here to Iowa. She decided to further her education, and she went to Des Moines College, and she graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in 1914, and then she went on to study law. And she passed the Iowa bar in 1918 after studying with her husband. And she became the first African-American woman in the state of Iowa to pass the Iowa bar exam. And she tried to get into the American Bar Association, but she faced a lot of discrimination and they kept refusing to admit her. So in response to that, the American Bar Association also refused to admit Black men. She and a handful of Black men who had been denied decided to create the National Bar Association. And they founded that in Des Moines, Iowa. And there's now a sculpture in downtown Des Moines. It's called A Monumental Journey. It's at the corner of Grand Avenue and 2nd, right next to the river. It's a beautiful sculpture. It's by Carrie James Marshall. And that sculpture memorializes the creation of the National Bar Association. Gertrude Durden Rush, she was also an activist throughout her life. And one of the things that she worked on was women's suffrage. I'm not sure if the Baptist Church still has this, but they used to have something called the Women's Convention. And I think it was the 1916 convention that Gertrude Rush actually spoke at. And her remarks at that convention were about women gaining the vote.
Now, at the Baptist Church, that was was that an integrated meeting or was that a Black-only meeting?
Well, I'm not sure about that, Susan, but I know that it was a national convention. I'm not sure if it was integrated or not.
And the National Bar Association, is that still a major National Bar Association?
It's still an organization that exists, yes.
And it is now integrated or not?
Well, if my memory is serving me. I think it still primarily serves African Americans, but I don't know that they deny, you know, admittance to others.
I see. Well, it's interesting how these issues have been so persistent.
Right.
You know, things that you thought were, you know, taken care of.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the reasons that we wanted to do this exhibition is, well, first of all, this being the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, we wanted to demonstrate to people that there was diversity in the movement. I think when a lot of us think about women's suffrage, we will think about Susan Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Carrie Chapman Catt, but, you know, those are all white women. African-American women were very much involved in women's suffrage, but their experience was different than white women. And that was the other thing that we wanted to show people. And then we did want to bring the story up to today. And as I mentioned with what we talked about in the webinar, there's still difficulties in African-Americans casting their ballot. And we wanted to highlight that as well.
Well, of course, and in Iowa right now, because of the new Jim Crow, because of felons not being able to vote.
Right. Iowa's the sole remaining state where if you have a felony conviction on your record, you have to petition the governor to have your voting rights reinstated. The governor, of course, has asked the legislature to pass an amendment to the state constitution. So that the voting rights of felons are restored, but the legislature has so far failed to do that. Even if the legislature were to do that for a state amendment, the amendment has to pass two sessions, and then it goes to the people of Iowa for a vote. So, you know, it takes a couple years for that process to play out. And then the governor has said that she is going to sign an executive order. The Black Lives Matter movement asked her to do that by the 4th of July, and we're all still waiting. According to the Des Moines Register, 1 in 10 African-Americans here in Iowa have a felony conviction on their record. So the fact that felons cannot vote greatly impacts the African-American community.
Yes, and of course, if it's delayed anymore, this will be one more election.
Exactly, exactly. Here in Iowa, we also have a voter ID law. There's a lot of states adopting voter ID laws. The reason for that is usually those who want to implement those laws say that they want to protect elections from fraud. But there's actually very little evidence that fraud exists in elections. And unfortunately, what happens with these laws is that African Americans don't have the required IDs in the same proportions as white people. And so those laws end up negatively impacting their right to vote as well.
Yes, actually, this is not pertinent to this particular discussion, but it's such a great story about voter laws, how election fraud has been used to hamper people's right to vote. It's a story that Karen Kudrowski told me yesterday about the state of New Hampshire in the colonial times. From 1776 until 1790, they had universal suffrage. They had women could vote. However, they repealed it on the grounds that men were dressing as women and voting twice. And when you think about the clothing, 1790, you know, all these men and well, probably they didn't have hoop skirts. Probably they just had long skirts. Dressing up to vote is pretty far-fetched.
Yeah.
But actually, this was one example of why you needed a national amendment rather than state laws or local laws, because then you just have a hodgepodge and you can be repealed and changed and you wouldn't have a universal guarantee. Well, it sounds like, is there anything that you would like to add to this since you have a forum?
Well, thanks, Susan. I guess what I'd like to say is the exhibition, again, is going to be traveling through the state of Iowa into 2021. We're still accepting bookings. So if you have a library or museum, or if you have an organization that is holding an event and you'd like to bring the exhibition, feel free to contact us. You can reach us through the website for the Community Museum, which is centraliowamuseum.com. And if you go to that website as well, if you click on the exhibitions tab, we have a list of all of the places that the exhibition is going to. When it wraps up its run at the State Historical Museum, it's going down to Page County in southwest Iowa, and it's going to be at three libraries there. And then it's traveling throughout the state. It's going to libraries and museums. And we've also gotten a lot of interest from universities around the state who want to bring it in so that their students can see it. Hopefully they'll be in person learning this fall and that they the students will be on campus and be able to see it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you. Sure sounds interesting.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Gina. Thanks for having me on today.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and your hosts, Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews, have been talking with Eric Morse about the exhibition he has curated toward A Universal Suffrage, African American Women in Iowa and the Vote for All. Eric was also here to tell us about the Central Iowa Museum, which is launching its first exhibition toward A Universal Suffrage, African American Women in Iowa and the Vote for All. It will be at the State Historical Museum in Des Moines until August 2nd, 2020, before it travels throughout the state. We'll end this with Standing on the Shoulders, the Women's Rights Anthem.
I am standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before me. I am stronger for their courage. I am wiser for their words. I am lifted by their longing for a fair and brighter future. I am grateful for their vision, for their toiling on this earth. We are standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before us. They are saints and they are humans. They are angels, they are friends. We can see beyond the struggles and the troubles and the challenge when we know that by our efforts things will be better in the end. They lift me higher than I could ever fly, carrying my burdens away. I imagine our world if they hadn't tried. Ones who came before me, I am honored by their passion for our liberty. I will stand I will work a little longer, and my shoulders will be there to hold the ones who follow me.
In case you just tuned in, you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts for today are Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen. You've just heard the Women's Rights Suffrage Anthem, Standing on the Shoulders, performed by Joyce J. Rouse, a.k.a. Earth Mama. Before we hear from Dennis Hart and Paul Wearson, we have a couple of announcements of events suitable for observing safe distances. The first is Ankeny Community Theater's next Virtual Theaters Theater, which will present an original play written by Melody DeRogalis called Vices. Meet the Larrington family, four grown siblings who navigate life as best they can, even if it is with a few innocent vices. Starring ACT regulars Susan Casper, Doug Moon, Kay Miller, and Michael Porsche, and directed by Melody DeRogalis, who, as you may have noticed, is also the playwright. So lots of good things coming from this talented company. We think you will find this fun and touching. Showtime is 7:30 p.m. on Sunday, July 12th. You can watch it from your home. It will last about 1 hour, and you can take part simply by going to the website to register. Registration is required by noon on July 12th, and we have the link on our website, or just go to www.ankenycommunitytheater.com.
For a real road trip, you can go to the Slater Area Historical Association's Heritage Hall Museum. That's at 318 First Street in Slater for the history of hats. It's available right now for viewing. You can call for an appointment to view. Over 50 hats are on display, accompanied by history, anecdotes, and photographs. Please call 515-480-9789. That's 480-8789 or 515-228-3293. Also, you can find those phone numbers on our website at khoifm.org. There's limited to a group of five, and masks are required. I've heard it's a very fun exhibit.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we are proud to bring you our veteran radio broadcasters, Dennis Hart and Paul Wearson. Are you both with us, Dennis and Paul?
Well, I'm with you, and I think Paul's on the other end of a line. Paul, are you there?
I am here, yes, Dennis. Good to see you from 10 miles away.
Paul, this is the first time you and I have been on the air together on this radio station since last October, and I have to tell you, even though I can't see you, I'm sure you're looking just as good as you did then, which wasn't that good, but I think you're looking just as good.
Yeah, that's it. I'm marginal at best, but yeah, we're all older, and we've gone through the winter and all that sort of thing, and then, of course, you and I were looking forward to broadcasting all this summer and COVID-19 intervened, but here we are back on the air, Dennis.
Yeah, and who could have guessed last October what the country would be going through in the last 9 months? I mean, when we signed off in October, we had not heard of the coronavirus, COVID-19. We had no idea that millions of people would lose their jobs. We had no idea of the social disruption. We had no idea what was going to be happening in terms of Black Lives Matter. The world has truly changed in those last 9 months.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, on an earlier program recently with Susan, I talked about my experience of dealing with COVID-19 in the winter, of course. And March was still cold. And it was quite, I'm out here on the farm. And so basically, I was isolated and more safe. I only went to the gas station and the grocery store Then, of course, when the weather warmed up, there are things to do outside here, like mow grass. And so it was more interesting to be on the farm. But you were in California. What was happening with you, Dennis?
Well, the virus began spreading quite rapidly. But at the height, at the beginning of the spread, when it became a public health crisis, my wife and I were actually in Orlando in Disney World for my birthday in that second week or so of March. And Disney World began shutting down while we were there. They literally shut the parks down, kept the resorts open, and we stayed for a couple of days until it became obvious that we needed to get back to California as quickly as possible because airlines were starting to shut down. There were some concerns we had about possibly being able not to get into California. Who knew what they were going to, what restrictions they were going to have as we landed out there. So we got out of Orlando about the middle of the week after Major League Baseball had announced it was shutting down, after the NBA had shut down, virtually every sport had shut down. The Orlando airport was nearly deserted. One of the world's busiest airports was deserted that day. We came out. We flew out on a plane that was two-thirds empty, got into the Phoenix airport, virtually empty, got on a flight to California, landed the same night that Governor Gavin Newsom in California declared a statewide shutdown and shelter-in-place order. And the governor said that literally millions of us in California could be subjected to the coronavirus, could become infected. It was one of the more frightening and daunting times we've spent just trying to get back to California, Paul. And then once we got there, everything shut down. Everything almost overnight. We were told to shelter in place. Businesses were closed. Restaurants, of course, closed. Churches closed. It was almost surrealistic when we got back.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, now we're several months down the road and we're trying to open up the economy. And, of course, there's a lot of political and economic pressure to do so. Plus, the weather changed and people wanted to get outside, especially given the fact that they had been indoors and confined, really, in their own homes for a long time. And so you have what we have now, which is a resurgence, especially in the Sun Belt, you know, in areas where people have beaches and all kinds of attractions to go out to. And this is concerning, what's happening in Arizona and California and Texas and Florida is really looking somewhat like New York in March.
Yes, it is. And one of the more disconcerting things, and this is certainly not a political statement, I don't mean it to be such, but I think we'd all agree there has been a lack of a unified response to the coronavirus, not just state by state, but at the highest levels of government. And that lack of response, unified response, has led to anger, confusion, and the state that we're in right now, which is that every state is really doing its own thing. Iowa had a different set of standards and restrictions, much less restrictive than California did. Florida opened up quite early after not really putting a whole lot of restrictions at any time on what was going on. And now here we are. Florida is literally blowing up with coronavirus cases. California reopened probably way too early, and now it's having a blow up of coronavirus. And the most frightening thing about what's going on, I think, is that all the experts, and remember, none of us had ever encountered this before, so we really didn't know what we were all talking about. But the experts were hoping that this would go away or at least mitigate as the hot weather came, and that has not been the case.
Well, yes, and you know, I listened to Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci because politicians on either side of the aisle have other agenda, you know. So I think that our guidepost should be the people who are epidemiologists and people who understand the spread of this disease and how quickly it can happen. And, you know, there were people downplaying it. People I talked to said, well, it's just the flu. You know, well, you know, for several days in a row in New York, almost 800 people were dying. And we remember the freezer trucks full of corpses and everything. So obviously, this is not the flu. Of course, you and I have lived a while. We've gone through several flu seasons. We have various antibodies. Plus, every year we have the opportunity to have the vaccine. But no one on planet Earth has any immunity to this illness, and still unsure what kind of immunity people have who've gone through the course of the disease. So everyone's learning, but at least the epidemiologists and science people know enough about the spread of disease, and no matter if it is a new virus, how it's likely to behave. So I try to listen to them, you know, and they're currently saying that if we're going to mitigate this, given the fact that we're going to be more out and about, masking is important, you know, because before, I really think we would have had a lot more deaths if we had shut down back in March, because that was a key moment when it could have really gone exponentially across the country. And now there's all kinds of arguments about masks. Where do you come down on that one, Dennis?
Well, I think that you have to follow what the experts say, the medical doctors, not what people on social media are saying. And the experts are saying that masks can prevent you, if you are asymptomatic and have the coronavirus, could prevent you from giving it to somebody else, could prevent somebody else from getting it. But the bottom line is, it's really not a constitutional issue about whether you ought to wear a mask. It's a health issue. And it seems like it's no big deal. It certainly isn't for me to, when I go into Fairway or any other store here, to put on a mask just as a sign that I'm aware there is a problem out there, and a serious problem that is infecting and killing many people. I'm going to do my part. It's my small part to keep my air away from other people. And that's really all we can do right now, is avoid sharing each other's air, because that seems to be what's spreading the coronavirus. And that seems to me to be a patriotic thing to do.
And also scientifically sound. The problem is, you know, you look at other countries who've been more successful in mitigating this illness. And my theory is that these countries, you have Singapore, you have all these other countries who dealt with this, even Red China, you know, various countries in Europe. And you have a situation where the population has been quite compliant. And my theory is that these countries have a history of kings and dictators and strongmen. They're a more obedient population. Here in America, we have this rugged individualism about no one telling us what to do, particularly the government. And we know that John Wayne would not wear a mask. Are you kidding me? I'm not going to wear a mask. Sure, I wear a bandana, but that's in case of a dust storm. Real men don't wear masks. Well, that's a totally bad thing to say, and of course inaccurate, but there's an element of that. It's been sort of passed down to us, our not only our tradition of not being told what to do, but also we have a rampant gent culture in this country. The Old West, you know, and the idea of the independent settler and rugged individualist. And there's a real strain in America of people not wanting to be told what to do, and they resent that, and they put aside the science and say, no, I'm not going to do this, and I'm a healthy person, particularly young people, you know. So I think that's what we're up against here, on the part of many people, and an unwillingness to mask because that's a sign of weakness or whatever, you know. These are my theories. You know, that's what keeps me up at night.
Well, I think it's also unfortunate, though, that some folks are seemingly unwilling to do what's good for the common good. In other words, we're all in this together. We all are at risk of coronavirus. And one thing the experts say, and they are the experts, they are the folks who actually deal with medicine, say is that putting on a mask might indeed and probably has helped curb the spread of the virus. And that doesn't mean that you have to wear it every hour of the day. I don't wear it when I'm out walking through Old Town, but I avoid people when I'm walking through Old Town. And every time I go into a store, and I don't do it very often, but I'm wearing that mask. I want to wear that mask, doing my small part, just to try to keep myself from getting sick and to try to keep others from getting sick. And it's somewhat discouraging to go into a particular store, and I won't name any stores. You've been there and I've been there, where some folks just apparently don't get it or don't want to get it or are ignoring it, ignoring the fact that we have a problem in this country. And it's not just the flu. We have vaccines for the flu. We don't have a vaccine for this.
No, exactly. And then another thing that was interesting during the peak of this, back in March, you know, the panic that ensued, particularly around toilet paper, There was a person behind me in the checkout line, and I don't know how many rolls of toilet paper she had in her basket, you know. And I thought, I almost told her, you know, you're going to use the last sheet of that toilet paper on Christmas Eve, you know. but there she was, and they sort of have a panic situation, you know, because basically that and paper towels and, of course, hand sanitizer. And there was just a run on that sort of thing. And it was behavior that sort of said, I'll take care of me in this situation. And everyone else fend for themselves, you know.
Yeah, who would have guessed that in this pandemic that toilet paper would have become the hoarding item? We couldn't find any in California for weeks in any store. It was just gone. It was out.
Well, you know, it always reminds me of the people who say, buy gold in case there's chaos. Well, if there's chaos and civilization dissolves into chaos, gold would be worthless, obviously. We'd go into a barter economy. And in March, I think toilet paper had the value of gold. So
one of the interesting things being back here in Ames, and we got back 3 weeks ago after a really difficult trip across country, because we had to plan to stay in areas overnight. We were driving to avoid the coronavirus, and that's more difficult than you think. We avoided every big city, and we took extra time to get out here. And to see the difference in Ames now from 9 months ago when we were last here is probably more dramatic for us than it is for residents here. This is a completely different town than it was. For one thing, there are very few crowds. Hardly anybody is on Main Street right now. Businesses have signs in front of their doors that you have to wear masks or wear clothes, whatever, et cetera. But almost everything has shut down, as you know, for the summer. And what we always have enjoyed doing during our time here is going to the Banshell Park concerts with the municipal band, the Roosevelt Summer Sundays concerts, 4th of July parade, and the breakfast, all gone, all completely gone. Ryman Gardens was shut down for a long period of time and now is only open in the exterior areas, nothing inside. It's a dramatic change. And on the 4th of July, Paul, just this last 4th, I got up early and I walked down Main Street at 9 o'clock in the morning on the 4th. Normally it would be bustling with pre-parade activity. I took a picture of it. There was no cars on Main Street. Not one person was on Main Street. And I was on the east end looking west. It was deserted on the 4th of July and it almost scared you. It was like a Twilight Zone episode where you'd gone into a town and no one lived in the town. I had never seen that on Main Street at any time in the years we've lived here.
Yeah, that reminded me of the old movie On the Beach with Gregory Peck, where all the streets were deserted in major towns. There had been a nuclear attack, you know, and it was just, you know, very dystopic. It was just it looked like a science fiction film when you're describing what you just experienced on the 4th of July. Utterly macabre, you know, that there would be no activity on Main Street when normally everyone would be getting ready for the parade. And just the absence of human contact and interaction. And I think that's what really has become a problem for a lot of people who live alone, for instance. You know, they're really cut off. On the other end of the continuum are families thrown together. And all the kids are home and you're expected to help them with schoolwork by Zoom, and all of the things that normally happen at school have to happen at home. Plus, it's just so compressed, you know, everyone's around each other all the time. And, you know, when they test you in submarine warfare in the Navy, they give you extensive psychological tests to make sure that you can live in a metal tube with other people, you know. Well, they weren't giving that test prior to the COVID epidemic, and so regular people were confined in submarines. And so I'm sure that a lot of things went up, like spousal abuse and tension and marital difficulties. And who knows what happened in many homes. We were just not accustomed to being thrown together all that time. So the people who lived alone were super isolated, and the folks who had young children and families about experienced living in a submarine.
You're absolutely right. Ursula did an excellent interview on this broadcast a couple of weeks ago with someone from the Ames Police Department. And that person said that the number of phone calls the PD had received had gone up exponentially this past summer in terms of abuse, in terms of alcoholism, drug abuse, as people were isolated inside more and more. More social dysfunction was taking place. And I think we saw a manifestation of that this past 4th of July evening, Paul. I don't know what it was like up in your place in Story City, but here in Old Town, where we have our house, more fireworks went off in the neighborhoods here, all illegal because you cannot set off fireworks in Ames legally. But they were booming for 3 or 4 hours, and I think more than I'd ever heard on the 4th of July, because people were pent up, having not done anything, been able to do anything for all of these weeks and months. And you saw it was almost a bombshells going off here in our neighborhood for 3 or 4 hours. I hadn't heard that kind of display ever here in Ames.
No, and I saw the picture, the aerial photos or video in Des Moines. Fireworks were going off everywhere. It looked like the pre-raid in Iraq when we began the Iraq War. There was just stuff flashing all over the city and various parts. It was constant, you know. So one more symptom of pent-up energy, and I understand that the fireworks stands did a land office business.
Yes.
People really bought and bought and bought.
So you wonder the big question
I'm just trying
to
reach it. Yeah, go ahead.
Big question I think we both have, and Susan would agree with this. I think we all agree with this. Where do we go from here? Because we're in uncharted territory. How do we get back to normal? And what is normal? I don't think we're ever going to get back to a point again in our lifetimes where we're going to be doing the same things we did prior to March of this year. Are we going to travel as freely as we did? Are we going to dine inside restaurants as freely and carefree as we once did? Are we going to go to the movies? I mean, in the best of times, movie theaters, if they're crowded, even in the summertime, have people who are choking and coughing and all of this. I don't know that I'm ever going to a movie again inside a theater. The way
and I'm a real film buff. Oh, I'm
I
a real
too.
Film fan. Yeah. And I love the experience of sharing a film with people in the audience. Now, there's a new chapter here because I'm the PA announcer for the high school baseball team. Well, there's a very compressed season. Like this week, games Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, and then that's the end of the season. And we went all last week. Well, I'm safe in the press box, but I just observed that nobody's wearing a mask. And they are social distancing to some degree. They were encouraged to bring lawn chairs so they could spread out. But the lawn chairs are side by side. And I think people feel that being outdoors gives them a measure of security. The problem is that as soon as anybody on a team tests positive for COVID-19, you have to go into a 14-day quarantine,
right.
And that means
right.
The season's over for that team, okay?
Yes.
So we haven't had a problem yet, but overnight, in fact, I think they interrupted a game and shut it down somewhere here in Iowa. A high school softball game because someone got sick. Well, you know, it's a calculated risk. And of course, when you look at the baseball crowd, you see some difference in the past. And of course, there are no concessions. And the only pay I got for my job was free food. And now I got to bring my food in a cooler. So I've actually taken a pay cut to below zero. And that's probably a W-1 form on your taxes.
It's really difficult to see how Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the National Hockey League are going to complete their seasons. You know, MLB is trying to get something going, and already teams have been infected with the coronavirus. Basketball is trying to get going down at Disney World in Florida in an enclosed bubble. Well, Florida, of course, is one of the worst states right now for the outbreak of the virus. And all it takes is one person to get into that bubble at Disney World, and the entire NBA season will be blown up. It may be, Paul, that we're trying to do too much too soon, but I fully understand why they're trying to do it. It's a matter of money and all of this, but boy, we are rushing things right now, perhaps.
Well, you see, there's an echo throughout the economy because look at college football. You know, you've got a situation where this is a multi-million dollar enterprise.
Oh, yeah.
And that's threatened. The same with professional football. You know, we're going into the fall when everyone's expectation goes up. The theater season begins, the TV season begins, football begins, both at the high school, college level, and plus NFL. And these are all what you'd say are rituals in our society that we can't imagine living without in its current form. So, as you say, how will our things normalize again when all of these signposts that we all value to herald this season change don't occur? It's going to be particularly obvious in the fall because that's a startup. It's so many things, you know. And some of that yields depression. You know, people, hope is hard to come by if everything seems to be vanishing. And that's why there's much more attention being paid to mental health. I noticed yesterday that some money is going to be freed up to finance mental health, mental issues for people here in Iowa. And that's a real concern because a lot of people have a lot of difficulties getting by in normal times. And this is when a time when people who are normally functioning pretty effectively suddenly lose their underpinnings and begin to question, am I safe? What's the future? You know, what's going to go on? And how do we continue? And I think that when that happens, you have sort of a fight or flight reaction. And certainly, I always look at the Titanic sinking. You know, that took 2 hours to take place. And during that time, some people soared and did such unselfish things. Other people did horrible things. It's, look at the people who did price gouging on toilet paper and things like that.
Right.
You know,
right.
A Susan's lot of people worried, misbehave.
Susan's probably worried that we're running out of time, and we are. But one more last word from me here, and it's been a pleasure with you today again, Paul. But it's going to be very interesting here in Ames, more than interesting. It's going to be quite a test when those 30,000 students from Iowa State come back in 4 or 5 weeks. And many of them perhaps bringing the coronavirus with them. That's going to be a test for this community. There's no question about that.
Right. And also, right now, schools are working out their policy. And once again, the state has allowed localities to make their own choices. And that will vary. You know, a lot of schools are going to require masks. Some are going to make it optional. There's all kinds of wiggle room there, and we don't know what happens if you put kids back in a classroom where there really isn't enough space to do the social distance thing, you know. So it's all new, unplowed ground and unprecedented activity we're facing in the fall.
Susan, I hope you don't think Paul and I have talked too much, and I hope you'll invite us back again.
Well, no, I've enjoyed what you've been talking about, and you know, we originally talked about what were the stories that would make our life different that have happened in this last 6 months or so. So we leave that for another time. So hopefully we'll see you back next week. Or
Susan, people who are 14 years old now have gained the right to tell their grandchildren, "You think this is tough? Let me tell you about my." And
you've,
be
been
right.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Jeannie McAndrews and Susan Franzen. Other voices you've heard are Eric Morse, Dennis Hart, and Paul Wearson.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. At noon, the Ames Public Library will present Reading Radio Live. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards, from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Standing on the Shoulders, the Women's Rights Anthem by Joyce Johnson Rouse, a.k.a. Earth Mama. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.